Confusion matrix.
Welcome to the Confusion Matrix, where we have lively and candid discussions about data, data science, and AI in day-to-day life, business, and beyond. I'm Alex Loveless.
And I'm Pete Hodge.
Hello, Pete. So, first point of order, we now have a name, which is the Confusion Matrix. I'm going to come back to that concept of the Confusion Matrix in a minute.
Indeed.
But I just wanted to fanfare the new title sequence, a new name, a new intro that we finally got round to in episode 2. And I'm quite pleased with it. What do you think, the intro section?
Yeah, I liked you chatted through, you know, how it was made and stuff. So in the last one, so it's quite good to see, you know, AI did us quite well there.
Well, I just wanted to briefly run through how that was made, because I think if we're going to end up talking about anything a lot, it's how to integrate these various things into your life and into your job and so on. And I think there's a lot of discussion already last week on where, for example, AI turns up all over the place, but also machine learning and how to use analysis and stuff. In the world at the moment, it's becoming all the more pervasive. So I wanted to quickly go through the process of making that and getting us to this second episode, just to illustrate some of those touch points, right? This is recorded using Descript, which has a bunch of AI features built into it. But the beginning and ending credits were created by me. Now, I could have probably just gone and got one of the multimodal AIs to build something for me, but I actually quite like doing this stuff. And what was the quote I heard the other day? I want AI to do my dishes so I can spend more time doing art. I don't want AI to do my art so I can spend more time doing my dishes, right? And so I quite like doing this stuff. And so how I did this was, I have a little homegrown application called the Image Mangler that exists to help me make generative art. And that is it's roughly speaking a highly constrained deep learning neural network based on, I think if I remember, it's on PyTorch. No, it's not. It's on something flow.
TensorFlow.
What's it called? TensorFlow. Yes, TensorFlow. And it tries to learn via a autoencoder that in real world would just remember an image and then be able to regurgitate it as, you know, as it was originally. But then I constrain it with the amount of layers, the amount of learning epochs and things like that, so that when it produces the image, so I get it to learn a whole bunch of images, and when it needs to recreate those, because it wasn't able to learn them properly, it mixes them all up and it gives these really cool results, right? All sorts of images mangled into each other, made to look good. And so I already had that running, and I used it to create a whole bunch of images that included lots of random stuff and then pictures of me and Pete, right? And that was all cool. And then I colorized it. So that I only teach it on black and white images. It produces black and white images, and then I colorize it using matplotlib, right? So I actually use matplotlib color maps, and you can just apply any, because you can take a monochrome image and put any color on it in matplotlib. It just changes the pixel values to that range. But I put in, instead of like blue, I put in like one of the random matplotlib color maps, and it creates these amazing spectral ghostly images. And that's what the images are that flash up in close succession. And then, as I discussed last week, I used Warp Terminal with their connection to various language models to write some code that created a super fast slideshow of lots of these images, just pointed towards a folder and say, randomly choose these images and then create this like super fast slideshow, and I had interspersed into that the logo. Well, so the first AI warp interaction created the grids you see, the little matrices, and then the second one created the video for me, and that was all very, very seamless. And then I sort of took bits and pieces of that and teased that out to create that sort of logo square that you get with a confusion matrix on it, and created more of these little slideshow videos with, you know, bits of it missing. So it creates that sort of degraded feel. I'd create that in Descript, and then I use some of the Descript homegrown effects, like to create some film-like noise and stuff on it, and some other degradation effects. So we had sort of glitches all over it. So I wanted a really glitchy feel, and that's the visuals. That's pretty much what I did with a few fades in, fades out. I didn't use many of the AI features on, or if any of the AI features on Descript to do that. I just used the tools that were available. And then finally, I did that the sort of soundtrack. Now, this is quite interesting, because I occurred to me, what I want is lots of different voices saying confusion matrix, like I was in a crowd of people, right? Because I wanted to have this sort of chaotic, confusing feel. And I was like, well, like, I could record myself over and over, but that's going to sound a bit weird. I could get some other people to record that. And then I remembered that OpenAI, ChatGPT, has a text-to-voice option, right? Which I've never used before, because I've never had need for it. So all of those voices were created by ChatGPT. And you can speed it up and slow it down. And some of the slower versions sounded weird as. And so that final clear one that you hear, where she says the confusion matrix, is like half speed, I think. And so I used Audacity to cut and paste and drag those overlapping each other. And that worked quite well. Although I'm thinking about it, it's another touch point I could have used Gen AI for, I would assume. But I just knew how to do it in Audacity. And then finally, I was like, well, I feel it needs a little bit more, like some melody or something, like a bit more of an audible hook. So I literally went to GarageBand, went through a bunch of weird synth effects on GarageBand, found one that I like, hit one note, and sequenced that out, dumped it out to MP3, added it, and voila, we have the opening sequence. So I think in terms of sort of illustrating using some of the things that we talk about here in day-to-day life, and how could I have done that whole process just with Gen AI? Perhaps. Would it have been as cool? Maybe. Would I have been as proud of it? Absolutely not. Would I have learned as much? Absolutely not. But did I use all of these bits and pieces of tools that I've learned, be it more traditional machine learning, neural networks, Gen AI, and then just traditional sort of sound and video tools? It just woven in there, I would not have got anything like that cool if I tried to do all that manually, for example, with iMovie. You know what I mean? So I think it's come out really well. I'm really pleased, and I'm quite pleased with a sort of end-to-end use case like that. And if I was to do it again, would I do it differently? Well, not dramatically, not right now. I might try the audio layering with a model of some sort, but outside of that, I'm pretty pleased.
Yeah.
Any questions, students? Yeah.
No, it's interesting that the voices reminds me of Blade Runner 2049, where the new replicant is sort of, I don't quite know what it is, but basically they're spitting two sets of audio at him at the same time. And there's something about that is left brain, right brain processing, but there's something else going on there. But it's hard as a human, because it's a weird thing to listen to, and you can see, and he's, I think it's listening to one channel of it and answering questions, but as a human, you tend to hear the other channel. Well, I did anyway. And so it's kind of weird. He sits in front of this screen and then it spouts a bunch of things in, which you don't quite get because they're kind of on top of each other, exactly like you've done. And then he's sort of answering these questions, of which you've heard snippets of. And it's this really weird sort of, and you're thinking, what's going on here? And I think it's, I think in the movie it is to indicate that he hasn't gone wrong yet, or something like that. And is it? But it's and he does it a few times where he sort of goes back into the room, and it's kind of like a, you know, like a debriefing or a deprogramming or something. But yeah, so it reminded me of that bit. I was thinking, oh, so maybe you put some subliminal messages in there, you know, like playing Black Sabbath backwards or something, you know, to conjure the devil or whatever it's supposed to be.
Black's not Black Pete, Pete. Not Black Sabbath
It's
backwards.
gonna be
Judas
Iron
Priest
Maiden,
backwards,
isn't
mate. Come on. Judas Priest, mate, you need to do better than
was
this.
it?
Yeah, and so I'm quite pleased that well, being compared to Denis Villeneuve, right? Seriously, is what you've done there. Like one of the most innovative and incredible directors of recent times. And so there we go. Me, Denis Villeneuve, Ridley Scott, you know, what's his face who did Inception. So I'm pleased with that company. I'll take that as a compliment. So next then, well, do you have anything more on that?
No, other than that, if you want to be compared with him, you have to make it a bit more orange because he seems to like orange in his films.
Okay, I've not even seen that Blade Runner yet, so
He did Dune as well,
I
didn't
hold
he?
fire on the orange. Oh, did he did, of course. Well, I've seen Dune. That's clearly orangey, yellow, and beige because it's in a big bloody desert. But Dune is good. Yeah, I'm good with that. So right. The next thing is we have a name for this podcast. I just want to discuss that briefly. Firstly, why do we have that name? I think the short answer is I brain vomited a list of stuff, and this one seemed the least offensive, and sort of seemed to have some level of crossover with what we're talking about in the sort of data science realm, but also sounded kind of mystical and arcane, and like it's got the word matrix in it, which sounds like we're in, you know, the matrix, as it were. And yes, we can be quite confusing. And the AI and data world is quite confusing, and therefore we have the confusion matrix. Is that your read on it?
And well, and I think data and AI is confusing. I think the world's quite confusing, and I think when they meet each other, it can be quite confusing. But also does have its very specific meaning in machine learning, which I think is also quite good.
Yes, and I wanted to talk about that, right? In case anyone listening to this doesn't know what a confusion matrix is, it's a real thing, right? So I've got one up on my screen here just to keep me honest. So you've got a table matrix, right? So it's a visual representation, and this is to understand performance of any type of machine learning classifier, right? So, pictures of cats and dogs. I need you to predict which pictures are cats, which pictures are dogs. They're both four-legged animals, and depending on the image and the algorithm and the model that you use, it's going to get some right and some wrong. It can get them right or wrong in basically four different ways, right? So we have this 2x2 matrix. So across the top of the table, you've got predicted and predicted. On the left-hand side, you've got actual and natural. And so we have the four squares in that matrix. From the top left, you've got the true positives. That's the good one, right, in this scenario. So you want true positives, which means it found a picture of a cat and it predicted it was a cat. Found a picture of a dog, predicted it was a dog. So that's good. So if you're 100% in that corner, you either have a really brilliant model or you massively overfit it, right? Top right, you have false negatives. So you're not predicting whether it's a cat or a dog. You're predicting cat or not cat, right? But since you only have cats and dogs in your photo set, it's only really predicting cat or dog or not dog, right? So false negatives. This is our cat. So confusing. This is our cat predictor. It's got a picture of a cat and predicted not cat, in this case, dog, right?
What you're saying is the prediction, is it true or false, cat? And you're saying the prediction said it was false. So is this a cat?
Yes.
No. So it's false, but the actuality is it was a cat. Yeah.
Then we have false positives. It got a picture of a dog and it predicted it was a cat. So it said yes, true to cat, but when it was a dog, right? And then you've got true negative is it got a picture of a dog and predicted it was a dog, right? So actually, what you want is top left and bottom right to be 100% accurate. And so what you actually get is the numbers of predictions that fall into each of these categories. And then you can use this to diagnose problems like type one, type two errors. So, it works in tandem with the, it's the F1 score, isn't it? So
Yeah.
ultimately, if you're on the top bottom left or top right, a lot, then your model isn't working well, and it might have a skew towards over prediction on dogs or over prediction on cats, or over predictions on false or over predictions on trues. And so it gives you an idea of how well your machine's working. If you've got mostly top left and bottom right with roughly equal low numbers in the other two, then you've got a pretty well balanced model that's working pretty well. As I pointed out, if you've got 100% on both, you've almost certainly overfit. And we can come back to overfitting another day, I think. But there you go. That's confusion matrix, right? Use them a fair amount.
I mean, I always see them as that, like you say, they're the square, and it's almost like you color out the diagonal line from top left to bottom right, and they're the ones you want to hit, and the other two, and if you make bigger ones, they're all the ones that you don't want to hit. So you want your numbers falling in the sort of diagonal, but like you say, even if they do, then you have to be a little bit suspicious. In other words, I've got 50 images out of 100 of cats, and I predicted that all 50 were cats. It is somewhat suspicious. You know, that means your model never makes a mistake, and
Well,
that's kind of like.
yeah, and I think it's quite an oddly unexplored facet of the mindset you have to be in to do any of this type of work is to be suspicious of good results, right? Be suspicious of things that look clean and very accurate, and because the world isn't clean and tidy, your business performance over time is not clean and tidy. Therefore, you can't expect your forecast to be very accurate because it would be deeply suspicious for it to be so, right? Pictures of cats and dogs aren't always that distinguishable, right? And for me, whenever I see something, I hit the perfect number, I got exactly what I was expecting, I'm immediately like, no, that's not likely. Maybe when I investigate, it's actually right and I just, hit the jackpot, but it almost never is. I've almost certainly introduced some sort of bias into the process. So be suspicious, right?
Yeah, and that really, I mean, that becomes a fundamental part of the shift from thinking of, I mean, we call them models, or you can call them AI, but the shift from thinking about computing around a model that's using data to predict something, and what people might have learned a bit more traditionally about computers, which is there are a bunch of logical statements and rules that a computer follows. So if you think of calculator, that's much more along the rules based, because we've got a bunch of rules around maths. We know that one and one equals two. There's always a right an answer, and that's what the calculator is going to do. The sort of stuff we're talking you'd use a confusion matrix on is you are using data, as in here in our example, pictures of cats, to input to a model where it learns what a cat is and what a cat isn't, effectively, to keep it nice and simple. And then you give it new data, so a bunch of pictures it hasn't seen, and you say to it, okay, here's a picture, is that a cat or isn't it? And so it's using the data to build a model, and then it's using that model to predict against, it's basically comparing the image, the new image, with its model, and coming up with a prediction. And so it's not following a rule. It's not saying, oh, if it's got this, this, and this, it's a cat. It's saying, oh, well, I've built a model around imagery, which sort of has a bunch of rules in it, but they're not rules input by the programmer. The things it's learned and the more images it loads up, like the human brain, the better it gets, hopefully. And then it's building those rules in inverted commas around the pieces it's pulling from those images. And then given a new image, it's trying to predict whether that is or not. And that goes for many, many things in this data realm. And hence why you end up with this confusion matrix where you're saying, you know, you don't need a confusion matrix to know that one and one equals two. I mean, you can use one, but to test a model. But the reason why we're doing it is because the algorithms that it's using to create that model have a stochastic, i.e., probabilistic element to them. And so when it does that prediction, there's a chance that that prediction is wrong because of some of the probabilistic elements in there. And so therefore, you need to rate it. Was it wrong? And then, okay, when you say wrong, why was it wrong? Did it predict cat and it wasn't a cat? Or did it predict not cat and it was a cat? Or did it predict cat and it was a cat? Or did it predict it wasn't a cat and it wasn't a cat? So they're the four that you get out of it. And that's what it's useful. And then the numbers we talk about is like, well, that's because we gave it 100 images. So of those 100, how many did it predict in each one? And then obviously, we can go through it as humans, and then we have a, in inverted commas, right answer. We go, well, actually, there were 75 cat images in there, and it only predicted 50. And that's when you can start to bring out some form of percentage of accuracy, which has its own problems. But you can say, well, there were 75 in there, and it got 50 of 75. So we can say, it got 50 over 75. Give it a percentage. And we could use that as one measure for accuracy. Now you still got those other three boxes to contend with, and you could get an accuracy out of that. But straight away you can start to see, well, already the idea of accuracy is starts to get not vague, but you start to go, well, which one do I pick as my measure? So yeah, that leads into a bunch of new confusion, which we probably don't want to go into right now. But
We definitely should cover this at some point. I mean, you
yeah.
get to the point where we're saying it can be too accurate, which to some people would be absolute anathema. But we're talking about, as you say, deterministic versus stochastic approaches here, and that we're dealing with the sort. I mean, if you want to add one and one, well, it's easy. You just do it. If you want to times, 275 by 943, pick up a calculator or stuff it into Excel. But because there's no ambiguity there, but there's massive amounts of ambiguity in terms of things like classification and so on. And you just simply can't have hard and fast outcomes that are absolutely, deterministic and are correct. And I think a lot of people find that quite mind bending. And indeed, I think a lot of data scientists find it quite mind bending because it's actually so hard. Because you're measuring accuracy across so many different parameters, and trying to look at it in so many different ways to try and diagnose what's going on below the hood, and I think it's a real challenge, and a confusion matrix is one of the good tools for helping, but you certainly couldn't get everything you need from it. Yeah, there we go. Confusion matrices. We'll delve deeper into the wonders of prediction accuracy on another day. Did you I've covered my items, Pete. Did you have something to bring to the party today?
Last week I was running through one of our case studies that we've done before, and I was just kind of getting a few bit extra bits down, and it was just quite a good reminder for me of how taking something which appears quite simple on the surface can really reveal so much of life. And what it was and I think it's applicable a lot across a lot of businesses, it was the amount of hours people are working on things. And some businesses are very tight on this, and some people don't bother. And so I think there's a fair spectrum of companies that either want to record time, are recording time, and then it's kind of what you can do with it. The specific use case that I had was we're recording people's hours and what they're doing, and can we glean more information from that? And there are a few specifics that they wanted to come to, which interestingly enough didn't turn out that well. But in digging through just this simple metric, you work 35 hours a week and you record what those hours are against. They're against project A, B, and C, or piece of work A, B, and C, in meeting X, in meeting Y. And obviously you can get into the whole away from my desk, getting a cup of tea, going for lunch, you can get into all sorts. And there are bits of other data which comes out of working, physically being in an office, like, you have an ID pass and you might be passing through doors for floors, doors into certain areas. And so you can start to sort of combine some of this together. But just to keep it simple, most companies, that have got people data, really what you want to look for is productivity. And so that might be, you might classify, going back to classification, you might classify some time as productive, so working on a project, working on client work, and some as non-productive, which might be going for lunch, or you might just scrap that time. And so actually, I'm not really even interested in that. Non-productive time might be seen as non-client meetings or any meetings, or and so you can cut these things different ways as to what you might see productive, what you might see non-productive. And a sort of starting point in there is, okay, well, so first thing you get is you start to get some sort of ratio for time spent in office, how much is spent on, in quotes, productive time, and how much isn't. And then, okay, we can roll that across a team of five might not be that useful. Across a sort of department or a team of 50 or 100, you start to get some sort of interesting bits across your whole company or a whole floor of people. You might be talking hundreds, thousands of people across different geographic areas, different countries. And so you'll start to get, a look and feel of data. And then you can start to make sort of comparisons against it. So are our colleagues in the US more productive than us or less productive than us? And then you can make that straight comparison, might go one way or the other. And then you can sit back and go, okay, well, that's interesting. These people here are more productive than these people here. Why? And that's the big thing that we would ask, why? And the next big thing we would ask is, so what? And so going down that route there, that's the fairly sort of standard productive, non-productive, could lead you down a few places, might lead you down a little bit of a place where you don't want to go, where you start to, and we've all heard some horror stories where you're starting to measure people and saying, oh, spending too long at lunch, too long away from your desk, cigarette breaks in the toilet, that sort of stuff. And I'm certainly not advocating that you would measure that. I think we've all heard of companies that are measuring time on your keyboard, keys clacked. Are you being productive in your typing? Or you're at your desk, but you're only actually using your keys for, 8 out of 12 minutes. You can really drill down here, which we don't think we really want to go into. But it's there, and there are some measures there, and there are some things that you can start to think about from that, and some questions. Why might one office in one region of the country be more productive in inverted commas than another? And you might not want to take that productive time as a hard and fast thing that you want to go and start chastising people by, but it might give an indication of why different areas work differently, which might actually help you in the future of how you think about measuring or giving targets to people. So even quite a lot there, and that's just my point one about the data, but I don't know, I'll let you have a tuppence worth in there, your thoughts.
Well, I immediately jumped to a podcast I was listening to the other day. I'll stick the link in the show notes. This Machine Kills have a sort of a they're a left wing technologist podcast. We're talking about sort of surveillance culture in the workplace and all of this. And it, you do have sort of two sides of the same coin here, because one side of it is productivity. And yes, Americans are more productive than Brits as per, you know, national level stats. But in terms of, you know, are you responding to customer emails? Are you typing lines of code? Which is more about surveillance than anything else. The flip side to it is in a service-based organization like a consultancy, which is, have you logged all the hours so we can charge the client, right? And have you charged the client enough money? And is your time being used effectively? And it gets ridiculous. You know, it's also heavily context-dependent. And one, as you can see, and by the way, I'm saying this, one bleeds into the other. You can see how you get from the point that we just want you to record your time properly so we can charge the client, to you went for a piss and it took you, you know, 30 seconds longer than is allowed in our company policy, therefore I'm going to censure you. And but one way or the other, you need data, and you need lots of it, and good data. And it's kind of hard, because we know that if you're tracking keystrokes to see what developers are doing, or what a copywriter or a journalist is doing, is nonsensical, right? You spend much more time glaring at the screen as a developer going, why the hell is this not working, than you do just tapping out like symbols on the keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. So I was going to pull out some of the other things that came out of it, which you kind of perhaps wouldn't see on the surface. And the first one of those was around building a profile of how people basically worked on different, I mean, I call them projects, right? So in any one week, they're working on between 5 and 10 different projects. Now you can just call that a piece of work or a style of work. And again, you can sort of see how you could define this in any workplace. You could then kind of find, you know, the average of how most people worked. And then you could start to look at people who were outside of those norms. So, you know, the average seemed to be that people worked on multiple things over a given week, but one or two things tended to take, you know, at least 50% of their time. And so that was a sort of classic profile. And then you look at, look at the people outside of those profiles. So what would that be? Well, on the one hand, it'd be someone that spends all their time doing one thing. And on the other hand, it'd be people that spent their time doing 20 things or 30 things or 40 things. So you can start to see that. And again, it's a big question then comes is, okay, well, what's the difference between these? And does it really matter? And in this case, it turned out, well, the people that tended to be doing multiple things and not anchoring into a bigger project tended to be new people into that business. And so that was quite telling. That was something I sort of thought, well, that's sort of interesting. And so that became a sort of bit of a hypothesis. This looks like people that are failing you in. And so, you know, there might be a few things. They don't quite know the run of the mill. They don't quite know, they haven't built up the relationships with people. They haven't had their skills and creds put to the test yet. And so they end up working on a variety of things, kind of why they find their feet. And that seemed quite logical to me. And so this was that translation of data into behavior, into, well, what's happening in real life. And then I went and spoke to one of the people managers, you know, sort of more the coaching type of people, and said, okay, I've got this hypothesis, I've got this data, I'm seeing this. Is that the sort of thing that goes on? They went, yeah, absolutely. This is exactly what we find. We'll get new people into the team. They'll try their hand at a whole bunch of things. And the more people who find their feet will gravitate towards this average. And people that continue to struggle, perhaps after 6 months, what you would see in the data is they still haven't found this anchor. They're still trying out lots of new things. And I just thought that was really interesting. So one, you know, my hypothesis was proven by talking to a real person. And then you start to think, okay, well, that's good. And we didn't take it any further, but you could then take that further, because that could become a useful tool for somebody that is watching over people. And that tool is, well, you know, essentially you're looking at these limits, and when people are falling outside of these limits over a certain amount of time, then that's indicating that perhaps they are, they're going through a change. Perhaps they're changing from one team to another. Perhaps they're new into the business, but also that might indicate that their productivity is going to be slightly lower, assuming that working on a project for 50% of your time or more is more productive, and someone that doesn't have that is therefore less productive. And so you want to minimize that. And so you could then use this as a flag to go and talk to people. Now, it might be something that a coach is already picking up, but of course, if you've got a machine running data, it becomes a useful tool to help prompt you for those people that you've not picked up. Because I know as humans, we would like to think, oh yeah, I'm looking over my flock and I'm 100% and I'm intuitive and I know exactly what's going on week. But it's easy enough to have your own issues to get pulled over onto another project. And then next thing you know, you haven't been checking in with people for 3 or 4 weeks and you're not sure. So great to have a tool which might highlight, well, this person's flicked over from, month 3 into month 4 of flitting across projects. Do you want to go and have a chat with them? Oh yeah, that's a good one. I hadn't noticed that. Great. And that would be really something useful, which isn't necessarily what went in to look for, and isn't what the, if you said to someone, here's time data for people, that's not really the first, they're going to think of, all oh, right, I'll build a profile and then work out who's different, and then use that in a good way. But it was something that came out, and in this case could have been used.
So we tend to ask different questions and look at the way the data differently. Partially because, well, if what you want to look at, if what you've got available is hours logged, which is pretty one dimensional, it's hard to read into. Well, we know that. We know you've got that. We're having this conversation because it's not enough, and it very rarely is. And we get into sort of a bit of a fractal state here because, because everything you said is perfectly reasonable. But the moment you start to measure something, you change it, right? And so in this scenario, you have well, you start to think, well, no, this is the way things should be, right? Rather than an observation of the way they are. And there, if someone's not, therefore, if someone's not conforming to that, you might try and change their behavior. Now, in some senses, that might be a good thing in some circumstances. In others, you might be taking someone who's actually very effective and making them less effective because of either the types of project they're working on, the type of brain that they've got, blah, 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 right? And so there's a sort of careful balance here. And between sort of understanding that things are a certain way to sort of keeping close tabs on that. And is it a merely a useful analytical outcome, or is it is a dashboard waiting to happen, and a law of unintended consequences, asserting itself. But I think it, as to the spirit of what you're saying, is that looking at data differently, you start to notice things that are not going to be obvious to other people, and you start to call out things that other people might have noticed latently, but maybe didn't attach much emphasis to or relevance to. And it just starts by being curious and to see and noticing patterns in the data that don't allude to anything clear and obvious that need a bit of poking down in. I think that's what we do well, is just spotting things that are going and going, well, what does that mean? Why is that like that? That seems a bit weird to me. And then figuring it out.
No, absolutely. And another thing that came out and really starts to go to what you're saying there about behavior and the change. Another element that came out was because these pieces of work were quite, some of these projects were short. I mean, when I say short, I mean, I'm, in coming from the IT world, project length 18 months, So when people are doing something in under a week, that's short. Even if you're, coming together doing work and it's knocked out in a month, that's pretty short, especially considering that piece of work is then ended and then you've got a new piece of work in. What you could see from the data was, okay, well, here's everyone's working on this project here, and there's three people that worked on that, they may not have even been in the same office. So are they really working on it together? Well, we don't really know from the data, because all it's saying is person one's putting time against project or piece of work A. But there's some sort of relationship there. And then you can throw in the sort of idea of duration. Well, how long was that for? Well, these three people worked on this piece of work together for a month. And again, was it really together? So that's something you can go and find out. Well, were they working on it together? And you know, and understanding how the piece of work. And if they were, you say, okay, well, that's they sort of worked as a team together. And then again, you add in time. Well, how often does that happen over the pace of 2 or 3 years? And so then you start to get a pattern of, in an environment where people are forming teams and relationships in a what you might call short term, disbanding, reforming, can you see patterns from that? And so again, you start to see, well, actually, you can see that this person's worked with this person 18 times in the past 3 years, you know. So what is going on there is that, you know, they form the relationship together, they realize they work quite well together. And so it's quite natural to then go and pick that person. What you've got here is a manager choosing people, you know, and this is akin to picking people from, you know, football at school, whatever's picking sports, and repetitively picking similar sorts of people. Then you start to look at the projects. Well, are they similar sorts of projects? And again, patterns may or may not emerge. To go to your point about behavior, is this can be both a good and bad thing. What you might spot is same people picking the same people to work on the good projects and then scattergunning around the not such good projects, you know. And so that starts to play into, well, is this person got a bias, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, you've got hard, complicated work. You want to put your best people on it. And you want to sort of get the people you're less familiar with and you become more familiar through doing slightly easier pieces of work and so forth. But also over time, over the pace of years, that might become a little entrenched, a little bit too systemic. So now the people that get picked are the better people all the time. And so if you're not seen as better in this person's eyes, are you now being excluded? And so, you know, that starts to lay into, well, are there some patterns here, again, which can help us? And it's really, you're really on the cusp here of, you know, slightly risky kind of checking out. But in an environment where you've got relationships forming and teams forming, having something that's helping out to point these things out, which, of course, is coming out of a machine, so is absolutely relentless. And is always putting out, rather than just people who are spotting the good things when they're having a good week and not spotting these things in a month where they're maybe too bogged down in one project or distracted by out of work things. You've got a machine spitting out inferences, which you can still choose to ignore, but might be quite useful. But of course, the moment that anyone gets their eyeballs on this, will their behaviour start to change? And will that be a positive thing or not? And all of these things you've got to weigh up in, okay, I can have a machine doing something for me here, might be quite useful, but I've got to be really careful of that useful then being used to game a system. And then it suddenly becomes not useful because people are being openly measured on it and everyone suddenly changes their behavior and you end up with that unintended consequence.
Yes, indeed. And people very rarely are careful. And I think it's a very underappreciated sort of aspect of what we do, especially when it comes to human behaviour. I think there's something here about complexity too. Emergent behaviours within complex environments and indeed the complexity itself. And I think one of the most interesting things, also biggest barriers to getting answers in that realm is simply, well, you've got a lot of people here doing a lot of things and across a lot of teams, across a lot of services, across locales, that's a lot of complexity. And yes, you're going to look at it and you're going to see maybe a whole bunch of what looks like homogeneity because the complexity is hidden. But then when you drill down to the next level, you start to find lots of variants, which is really hard to explain, and lots of sort of quasi-emergent behavior going, well, what's this lot over here doing and what are they doing, and why has this changed to be like this rather than to be like that it was before, and some of it is explainable because oh no, that's because you changed the rules on X or you changed the reward profile for it, and some of it might just be because stuff shifts, things change, humans grow, complex environments will swing back and forth, and back to the whole sort of chaos theory, butterfly flaps its wings, a fairly small thing within that overall environment, like someone who was like a key influencer, even if they were quite junior, left, who provided the bridge between a lot of teams, and suddenly those teams spin apart, right? Which is a really common thing, and no one notices it because that person was a no one, but they don't recognize that they're the effect of doing some of these things, and I think that type of stuff is very underappreciated, but it makes our job really hard because what business users want is certainty. So I asked you to calculate this metric so I would understand things, and what we often have to go back with is it's not really that simple. There's no black and white here. Because you work within a very complex system, and they want very simple, very direct interpretations, and we have to say, well, there's a few ways of interpreting this, or we have to go back to them and say, no, there's not enough data, right? You're not collecting enough data about the right people, and all of that combines to make us unpopular all times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're all. From our point of view, they're all good answers, but like you say, they're not necessarily the answers people want to hear. They want a solution to the problem. We're saying this is really complex. What I like about it is there's usually a way through that complexity, and then there's a way, you know, there's hypotheses you can pull out of that and then say, well, we don't know if this is right, but it appears that this is happening. So if we try this, then this other thing may happen. You know, and we got data, we're looking at it, so we can quickly tell whether we're right or wrong here, and that's how we roll, but it's not how other people roll. And that would definitely be a topic for another day, but you know, it's what makes our job both interesting and very frustrating.
Yes, indeed. Frustrating. And on that note, I think we should bring this to a close, because I know we could talk forever. So thank you for that. We'll be back again soon. Don't know how soon, but with more stuff, more fun, more data and AI related hijinks. Thank you for listening, everybody, and we'll see you again soon.
Cheers, bye.